plushcare.com. Healthcare that makes you smile. Virtual primary care and mental health treatments when you need it. Get personalized, high-quality healthcare by talking to top U.S. medical doctors, all from the ease of your smartphone. Care for you and the ones you love most. High quality. Our highly skilled online doctors are trained at the top U.S. medical schools with an average of 15 years experience. Our online doctors give you and your entire family the peace of mind you should expect from your healthcare provider. Convenient? Just book an appointment, that chat via video on your smartphone, and pick up your prescription from your pharmacy. Our advanced technology is integrated with most major insurers, labs, and pharmacies. Affordable? Talking to an online doctor has never been easier and more affordable. For just your copay or just $99 per visit, you can get quality care from one of our highly skilled online doctors. We are in network with most major insurers in the U.S. and provide care in all 50 states. Over 450,000 patients cared for. Hope you had a good week. Here's Chapter 8 of Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little Town on the Prairie, titled 4th of July. Boom! Laura was jerked out of sleep. The bedroom was dark. Carrie asked in a thin, scared whisper, "What was that?" "Don't be scared," Laura answered. Now listen, the window was hardly gray in the dark, but Laura could feel that the middle of the night was past. Boom! The air seemed to shake. "Great bed," Pa exclaimed sleepily. Why, great?" Grace demanded. "Pa, Ma, why?" Carrie asked. "Who is it? What are they shooting? What time is it?" Ma wanted to know. Through the partition, Pa answered, "It's 4th of July, Carrie." The air shook again. Boom. It was not great guns. It was the gunpowder exploded under the blacklist anvil in town. The noise was like the noise of battles on America's fought for the independence. 4th of July was the day when the first Americans declared that all men are born free and equal. Boom. "Come, girls, we might as well get up," Ma called. Pa sank. "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?" "Charles," Ma protested, but she was laughing because it really was too dark to see. "It's nothing to be solemn about," Pa jumped out of bed. "Hooray, we're Americans," he sang. "Hooray, hooray, we'll sing the Jubilee. Hooray, hooray, the flag that sets men free." Even the sun as it rose, shining into the clearest of skies, seemed to know this day was a glorious 4th. At breakfast, Ma said this would be a perfect day for a 4th of July picnic. "Maybe the town will be far enough along to have one come next July," said Pa. "We couldn't hardly have a picnic this year anyway," Ma admitted. "It wouldn't seem like a picnic without fried chicken." After such a rousing beginning, the day did seem empty. Such a special day seemed to expect some special happening, but nothing special could happen. "I feel like dressing up," Carrie said while they did the dishes. "So do I, but there's nothing to dress up for," Laura replied. When she carried out the dishwasher to throw it far from the house, she saw Pa looking at the elves. They were growing thick and tall, gray, green, and smoothly rippling in the wind. The corn was growing lustily too. Its long, yellow-green, fluttering leaves almost hid the broken sod. In the garden, the cucumber vines were reaching out their crawling tips, uncurling beyond patches of spreading big leaves. The rows of peas and beans were winding, rounding up. The carrots rows were feathery green, and the beets were thrusting up long dark leaves on red stems. The ground cherries were already small bushes through the wild grasses. The chickens were scattered, chasing insects to eat. All this was satisfaction enough for an ordinary day, but for 4th of July, there should be something more. Pa felt the same way. He had nothing to do on 4th of July, no work could be done except the chores and housework. In a little while, he came into the house and said to Ma, "There's a kind of celebration today. Would you like to go?" "What kind of celebration?" Ma asked. "Well, mostly horse racing, but they took up a collection for lemonade," Pa replied. "Women aren't likely to be at a horse race," Ma said, "and I could go calling uninvited on 4th of July." Laura and Carrie stood almost bursting with eagerness while Ma considered and shook her head. "You go along, Charles. It would be too much for Grace anyway." It is much nicer at home," said Mary. Then Laura spoke. Oh, Pa, if you go, kick Carrie and I. Pa's doubtful eyes brightened and twinkled at her and Carrie. Ma smiling. Yes, child, it will be nice outing for you all. She said, run down cellar and bring up the butter, Carrie. And while you're dressing, I'll put up some bread and butter for you to take along. Suddenly, the day seemed really 4th of July. Ma made matches, Pa blacked his boots, Laura and Carrie hurriedly dressed up. Luckily, Laura sprigged calico with specially washed and ironed. She and Carrie took turns scrubbing their faces and necks and ears pink. Over their unbleached muslin union suits, they put on crackling stiff petticoats of bleached muslin. They brushed and braided their hair. Laura wound her heavy braids around her head and pinned them. She tied the Sunday hair ribbon on the ends of Carrie's braids. Then she put on her fresh sprigged calico and buttoned it up the back. The full ruffle on the bottom of the full skirt came down to the tops of her shoes. Please button me up, Carrie asked. In the middle of her back, there were two buttons that she couldn't reach. She had buttoned all the others outside in. You can't wear your buttons turned inside at 4th of July, at a 4th of July celebration, said Laura, unbuttoning them all and unbuttoning them again properly. If they're outside, they keep pulling my hair, Carrie protested. My braids catch on them. I know, mine always did, said Laura, but you just have to stand until you're big enough to put your hair out. They put on their sunbonnets. Pa was waiting, holding the brown paper packet of sandwiches. Ma looked at them carefully and said, you look very nice. It's a treat to me, but to be stepping out with my two good-looking girls, said Pa. You look nice too, Pa, Laura told him. His boots were glossily polished, his beard was trimmed, and he was wearing a Sunday suit and broad-brimmed felt hat. I want to go, Grace demanded, even when Ma said no, Grace. She repeated two or three times, I want to, because she was a baby. They had almost spoiled her. Now her unruliness must be nipped in the bud. Pa had to set her sternly in a chair and tell her, you heard your Ma speak. They set out soberly unhappy about Grace, but she must be taught to mind. Perhaps next year she could go if there were a big celebration, and they all rode in the wagon. Now they were walking to let the horses stay on their picket ropes and eat grass. Horses grow tired standing all day at hitching posts in dust and heat. Grace was too little to walk the mile and back, and she was too big to be carried. Even before they reached town, they could hear a sound like corn popping. Carrie asked what it was, and Pa said it was firecrackers. Horses were tied along the whole length of Main Street. Men and boys were so thick on the sidewalk that in places they almost touched each other. Boys were throwing lighted firecrackers into the dusty street where they sizzled and exploded. The noise was startling. I didn't know it would be like this, Carrie murmured. Laura did not like it either. They had never been in such a crowd before. There was nothing to do but keep on walking up and down in it, and to be among so many strangers made them uncomfortable. Twice they walked the two blocks with Pa, and then Laura asked him if she and Carrie could not stay in this store building. Pa said that was a fine idea. They could watch the crowd while he circulated a little. Then they would eat their lunch and see the races. He let them into the empty building, and Laura shut the door. It was pleasant to be alone in the echoing, bare place. They looked at the empty kitchen behind it, where they all lived huddled during the long, hard winter. They tiptoed upstairs to the huddled, hot bedroom under the eaves of a shingle roof and stood looking down from the front row at the crowd and at firecrackers squirming and popping in the dust. I wish we had some firecrackers, Carrie said. They're guns, Laura pretended. We're in Fort Ticonderoga, and those are British and Indians. We are Americans fighting for independence. It was the British in Fort Ticonderoga, and the Green Mountain Boys took it, Carrie objected. Then I guess we're with Daniel Boone in Kentucky. But this is a long stockade, said Laura. Only the British Indians captured it, she had to admit. How much do firecrackers cost, Carrie asked. Even if Pa could afford them, it's foolish to spend money just to make a little noise, Laura said. Look at that little bay pony. Let's pick out the horses we like best. You can have first choice. There was so much to see that they could hardly believe it was noon when Pa's boots sounded downstairs and he called, "Girls, where are you?" They rushed down. He was having a good time. His eyes were twinkling bright. He sang out, "I've brought us a treat, smoked herring to go with our bread and butter. And look what else," he showed them, "a bunch of firecrackers." "Oh, Pa," Carrie cried, "how much did they cost?" "Didn't cost me a cent," said Pa. "Lawyer Barnes handed them to me and said, give them to you girls." "Why on earth did he do that?" Laura asked. She had never heard of Lawyer Barnes before. "Oh, he's going in for politics, I guess," said Pa. "He acts that way, affable and agreeable to everybody. You want me to set these off for you now or after we eat?" Laura and Carrie were thinking the same thing. They knew it when they looked at each other, and Carrie said it. "Let's save them, Pa, to take home to Grace." "All right," said Pa. He put them in his pocket and undid the smoked herring while Laura opened the packet of sandwiches. The herring was delicious. They saved some to take home to Ma. When they had eaten the last bit of bread and butter, they went up to the well and drank long and deep from the edge of the pail that Pa drew dripping up. Then they washed their hands and their hot faces and dried them in Pa's handkerchief. It was time to go to the races. The whole crowd was moving across the railroad tracks and out on the prairie. On the pole set up there, the American flag fluttered against the sky. The sun was shining warm and a cool breeze was blowing. Beside the flagpole, a man rose up tall above the crowd. He was standing on something. The sound of talking died down and he could be heard speaking. "Well, boys," he said, "I'm not much good at public speaking, but today is a glorious fourth. This is the day and date when our forefathers cut loose from the despots of Europe. There wasn't many Americans at that time, but they wouldn't stand for any monarch tyrannizing over them. They had to fight the British regulars and their hired Hessians and the murdering, scalping, red-skinned savages that those fine gold-laced horses turned loose on our settlements and paid for murdering and burning and scalping women and children. A few barefoot Americans had to fight the whole of them and lick them, and they did fight them and they did lick them. Yes, sir, we licked the British in 1776 and we licked them again in 1812, and we backed all the monarchies of Europe out of Mexico and off this continent less than 20 years ago, and by glory, yes, sir, my old glory right here, waving over my head. Any time the despots of Europe try to step on America's toes, we'll lick them again. Hooray, hooray," everybody shouted. Laura and Carrie and Paul yelled too, "Hooray, hooray." "Well, so here we are today," the man went on. "Every man, Jack of us, a free and independent citizen of God's country, the only country on earth where a man is free and independent. Today is the 4th of July when this whole thing was started, and it ought to have a bigger, better celebration than this. We can't do much this year. Most of us out here are trying to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. By next year, likely some of us will be better off and be able to chip in for a real big, rousing celebration of Independence Day. Meantime, here we are. It's 4th of July, and on this day, somebody's got to read the Declaration of Independence. It looks like I'm elected, so hold on. Hold your hats, boys. I'm going to read it." Laura and Carrie knew the Declaration by heart, of course, but it gave them a solemn, glorious feeling to hear the words. They took hold of hands and stood listening in the solemn, listening crowd. The stars and stripes were floating bright against the thin, clear blue overhead, and their minds were saying the words before the ears heard them. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to solve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth that separate the equal station to which the laws of nature of God's entitle them, a decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be so evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Then came a long and terrible list of crimes of the king. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states. He has obstructed the administration of justice. He has made judges dependent on his will alone. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out of their substance. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, destruction and tyranny already begun with certain circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America and General Congress, assembled appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our attendance due in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and have right out to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states they have full right to levy war, and for the support of the Declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other that other our lives and for and our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. No one cheered. It was more like a moment to say amen, but no one quite knew what to do. Then Paul began to sing all at once. Everyone was singing. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Long may our land be bright with freedom's holy light. Protect us by thy might, God, great God, our King. The crowd was scattering away then, but Laura stood stock still. Suddenly she had a completely new thought. The Declaration and the song came together in her mind, and she thought, God is America's King. She thought, Americans won't obey any king on earth. Americans are free. That means they have to obey their own consciousness. No king bosses Pa. He has to boss himself. Why, she thought, when I am a little older, Pa and Ma will stop telling me what to do, and there isn't anyone else who has a right to give me orders. I will have to make myself be good. Her whole mind seemed to be lighted up by that thought. This is what it means to be free. It means you have to be good. Our Father's God, author of liberty, the laws of nature, and of nature's God, endow you with the right to live, to life and liberty. Then you have to keep the laws of God, for God's law is the only thing that gives you a right to be free. Laura had no time to think any further. Carrie was wondering why she stood so still, and Paul was saying, this way, girls, there's the free lemonade. Carol stood in the grass by the flagpole. A few men were waiting for their turns to drink from the tin dipper. As each finished drinking, she handed the dipper on and then strolled away toward the horses and buggies and on the racetrack. Laura and Carrie hung back a little, but the man who had the dipper saw them and handed the dipper to Pa. He filled it from the barrel and gave it to Carrie. The barrel was almost full, and slices of lemon floated thick on the lemonade. I see they put in plenty of lemon, so it ought to be good, Pa said. While Carrie slowly drank, her eyes grew round with delight. She had never tasted lemonade before. They just mixed it, one of the waiting men told Pa. The water is fresh from the hotel well, so it's full. Another man who was waiting said, It depends, son, on how much sugar they put in. Pa filled the dipper again and gave it to Laura. She had once tasted lemonade at Nellie Olson's party when she was a little girl in Minnesota. This lemonade was even more delicious. She drank the last drop from the dipper and thanked Pa. It would not be polite to ask for more. When Pa had drunk, they went across the trampled grass to the crowd by the racetrack. A great ring of sod had been broken and the sod carried off. The breaking plow with its coulter had left the black earth smooth and level in the middle of the ring, and all around it was the prairie grasses were waving, except where men and buggies had made trampled tracks. Why, hello, Bose, Pa called, and Mr. Bose came through the crowd. We had just got to town in time for the races. Mrs. Bose, like Ma, had preferred to stay at home. Four ponies came out on the track. There were two bay ponies, one gray and one black. The boys who were riding them lined them up in a straight row. Which did you bet on if you were betting? Mr. Post asked. Oh, the black one, Laura cried. The black pony's coat shone in the sunlight, and his long mane and tail blew silky on the breeze. It tossed its slender head and picked up its feet daintily. At the word go, all the ponies leaped into a row. Run, the crowd yelled, stretched out low and fast. The black pony went by and the others behind it. All their pounding feet raised a cloud of dust that hid them. Then around the far side of the track they went, running with all their might. The gray pony crept up beside the black, neck and neck they were running. Then the gray pulled a little head and the crowd yelled again. Laura still hoped for the black. It was doing its best. Little by little it gained on the gray. Its head passed the gray's neck. Its outstretched nose was almost even with the gray's nose. Suddenly all four ponies were coming head on down the track, quickly growing larger and larger in front of the coming death. The bay pony was the bay pony with the white nose came skimming past the black and the gray across the line ahead of them. Both while the crowd cheered. If you bet on the black, Laura, you'd have lost, said Ma. It's the prettiest boat, Laura answered. She'd never been so excited. Carrie's eyes shone. Her cheeks were pink with excitement. Her braid was snared on a button and recklessly she yanked it loose. Are there any more, Pa? More races? Carrie cried. Sure. Here they come for the buggy race, Pa answered. Mr. Bose choked. Pick the winning team, Laura. Through the crowd and out onto the track. Through the crowd and out onto the track came first a bay team hitched to a light buggy. The bays were perfectly matched and they were stepped as though the buggy weighed nothing at all. Then came the other team's other buggies, but Laura hardly saw them, for there was a team of brown horses that she knew. She knew their proud gay heads and arching necks, the shine of light on their satiny shoulders, the black manes flowing on the forelocks tossing above their quick, bright, gentle eyes. Oh, look, Carrie, look, it's the Brown Morgans, she cried. That's Alonzo Wilder's team, both, said Pa. What in creation has he got him hitched to? High above the horses, Alonzo Wilder was sitting. His hat was pushed back on his head, and he looked cheerful and confident. He turned the team toward his place in line, and they saw that he was sitting on a high seat on top of a lone high, heavy wagon with a door on its side. It's his brother Royal's peddler's wagon, said a man standing nearby. He don't have a chance with that weight against all those light buggies, said another. Everyone was looking at the Morgans, and the wagon was talking about them. The off-horse prince is the one he drove last winter, that 40-mile trip that he and Cap Garland made and brought in the wheat that kept us all from starving to death, Pa told Mr. Bose. The other one's lady that ran off with the antelope herd that time. They both got good action and speed. I see that, Mr. Bose agreed, but no team can haul that heavy heart and beat Sam Owens based on his light buggy. Seems like the young fellow might have rousted out a buggy somewhere in this country. He's an intimate kind of a young cuss, someone said. He'd rather lose with what he's got than win with a borrowed buggy. Too bad he don't own a buggy, Mr. Bose said. The brown horses were by far the most beautiful on the track and so proud. They did not seem to mind the heavy wagon at all, but tossed their heads, pricked their ears, and lifted their feet as if the ground were not quite good enough for them to step on. Oh, what a shame. What a shame they haven't a fair chance, Laura was thinking. Her hands were clenched. She wished so much that those proud, fine horses might only have a fair chance. Hitched to that heavy wagon, they could not win. She cried out, it isn't fair. The race started, fast came the bays, leading all the others. The shining lays trotted and the wheels whirling hardly seemed to touch the ground. Every buggy rushing by was a light one-seated buggy, not a team crew. Even the weight of a two-seated buggy, except the beautiful brown horses who came last, pulling the high, heavy peddler's cart. Best team in the country, Laura heard a man say, but not a chance. Nope, said another. That wagon's too heavy for them to pull. Sure as shooting, they'll break their trot. But they were pulling it, and they were trotting evenly without a break. Their eight brown legs kept moving in a perfect trot. The dust cloud rose up and hid them, then bursting out of it up the other side of the track. The teams and buggies were speeding. Two buggies were behind the peddler's cart. Three buggies were behind it. Only the bays were ahead of it. Oh, come on, win, Laura was begging the brown horses. So she so wanted them to win, to trot faster, that since her wishing was pulling them. They were almost around the track. They were coming round now around the turn and on toward the line. The bays were ahead, the Morgans could not do it. They could not win. The weight was too much for them, but still Laura kept on wishing with all her, "Faster, faster, only a little faster. Oh, come on, come on." Laura Amanda leaned forward from the high seat and seemed to speak to them. Still smoothly trotting, they came faster. Their heads reached Mr. Owen's buggy and slowly, smoothly crept higher. All the legs were moving fast, fast, while so slowly the brown heads came up even with the bays. All four horses were coming now in a line, faster, faster. "A tie, by gosh, it's a tie," a man said. Then Mr. Owen's buggy whip flashed out. It went, it swished down once, twice as he shouted. The bays leaped ahead. Amazo had no whip. He was leaning forward, lightly holding the reins firm. Once more, he seemed to speak. Fast and smooth and slow of flying, the Grand Morgans passed the base and crossed the finish line. They'd won. The whole crowd shouted. It surged to surround the brown horses and Monzo high on the cart. Laura found that she had been holding her breath. Her knees were wobbly. She wanted to yell and to laugh and to cry, to sit down and rest. "Oh, they won, they won, they won," Carrie kept saying, clapping her hands. Laura did not say anything. "He earned that $5, said Mr. Bose. "What $5? Carrie asked. "Some in a tent put up $5 for the best trotting team," Pa explained. "Monza Wallace won it." Laura was glad she had not known. She could not have borne it if she had known that the brown horses were running for a $5 prize. "He has it coming to him," said Pa. "That young man knows how to handle horses." There were no more traces. There was nothing more to do but stand around and listen to the talking. The lemonade low in the barrel. Mr. Bose brought Laura and Carrie a dipperful, and they divided it. It was sweeter than before, but not so cold. The teams and buggies were going away, then Pa came from the dwindling crowd and said it was time to go home. Mr. Bose walked with them along Main Street. Pa said to him that the Wilders had a sister who was a school teacher back east in Minnesota. "She's taken a claim half a mile west of town here," said Pa, "and she wants a Monza to find out if she can get this school to teach next winter. I told him to tell her to send in her application to the school board. Other things being equal, I don't know why she can't as well have it." Laura and Carrie looked at each other. Pa was on the school board, and no doubt the others would feel as they did. Laura thought, "Maybe if I am a very good scholar, and if she likes me, maybe she might take me driving behind those beautiful horses." Thanks for listening to this chapter. Have a good week and stay safe.